Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.
Yeah, no, I want to come back also to what you were saying about the predictive power of IQ and conscientiousness, which I don't dispute, and I'm also not one of these people who suffers under the delusion that these things are totally, open quotes, socially determined, close quotes. I mean, I understand and believe that they have high heritability and identifiable genetic sources in that variability and so on. But, you know, the standard old joke used to be, you can tell me because you know more about personality psychology than I do, the standard old joke used to be that everything's 50% heritable, that that pretty much anything that you can measure as a trait that has any stability within the lifetime also turns out to have a heritability somewhere near 0.5. But there's the other 0.5. You know, some people have low IQs because they were exposed to too much lead in infancy. You know, I believe that conscientiousness can probably be, I believe you suggested earlier that we know something about this already, about developmental determinants of shifts in conscientiousness. And so, you know, we have to caution ourselves against talking about these individual difference factors as if they are immutable attributes of individuals that are going to undermine any sort of progressive improvement of circumstances for people, are going to create bad byproducts of attempts to produce social justice. It's just going to, you know, you're going to leave your dumb, unconscientious people out there being parasites or something.
Well, you know, there is, of course, decent evidence that there are sociocultural effects on IQ. I mean, the Flynn effect, which is named after the man who described the phenomena, indicates that the average IQ has been increasing quite substantially over the last 100 years. And the reason for that, no one knows for sure, but one of the putative reasons for that is that we've lifted the bottom out of catastrophe. So yeah, there aren't people whose IQs are stunted by exposure to zero information during critical developmental periods and who didn't get enough to eat.
Yeah, so I was going to say severe malnutrition, never mind zero information. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we've wiped out, in many ways, we've wiped out the worst effects of privation. And that's increasingly true as well on the worldwide scale, worldwide stage. You know, there's about 150,000 people a day right now being lifted out of absolute poverty by UN standards, the fastest improvement in the history of the world by a huge margin, and also about 300,000 people a day being hooked up to the electrical grid. So we are making some progress removing the absolute privation problem, which is a non-trivial problem. The problem with most of the attempts to raise IQ is that they don't change the variance in IQ. They tend to raise the average IQ across the population. And that leaves the inequality, IQ inequality problem basically untouched. So there have been studies trying to estimate how much socioeconomic pressure, let's say, you have to place on an individual to raise their IQ. Lowering it's easy, right? Because making something worse is always easier than making something better. But if I remember correctly, if you take an identical twin who's adopted out at birth, in order to produce a 15-point increase in IQ compared to the other twin, which is a one standard deviation increase, and about the same as the average difference between a university student in an average state college and an average high school student, you have to move the one twin from the 5th percentile of socioeconomic status to the 95th percentile. So you need about a 3 standard deviation improvement in socioeconomic conditions to produce a 1 standard deviation improvement in IQ. So it looks like it can be done, but it's expensive. You know, and
yeah, I see what you're saying. I'm kind of surprised, actually. I mean, given, you know, we just mentioned malnutrition as one possible source of low IQ, one possible developmental source. I'm kind of surprised that to the degree that the Flynn effect might be due to things like a reduction of the number of people exposed to severe malnutrition, that it wouldn't have also simultaneously truncated the variance a little bit. That seems slightly surprising.
Well, it has truncated. Let me restate that. It has truncated. It has truncated the variance, although the data on that isn't as clear. Uh-huh. So, but I do believe that it's a reasonable inference to make that the variance has been truncated. It's also hidden to some degree because the IQ tests are always renormed to keep the variance at a standard 15 points.
Yes.
So it makes it difficult to look retrospectively and see what's happened to the variance. So, the other problem too is that, you know, you get these stories now and then about these companies that come out with claims that their brain exercises can improve IQ, and the literature on that is damn dismal, I can tell you. It's that the holy grail is to produce cognitive exercises that produce a legitimate impact on fluid intelligence, and like there has been a lot of work done on that, and the answer so far is that it doesn't work.
So what about the video gaming? I mean, I know there has been this suggestion that playing video games actually improves at least some aspects of intelligence.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of studies that indicated that video games might improve spatial intelligence, but yeah. Here's the problem, and I think this is a critical problem and perhaps an insoluble one, or at least no one solved it, is that what you get is that if you exercise yourself substantially on a given game, you can radically accelerate your performance in the game. So you can get much better at those specific skills.
Sure.
But you don't get generalization across cognitive sets, which is what you're really hoping for. Because
I thought that was the claim from some of these.
Yeah, well, they have shown some increases in spatial IQ, but there's not very many studies. And I would say they're far overbalanced by the other side of the research equation, which continually says, and I've looked at this because I'm really interested in the improvement of IQ. I mean, that's the holy grail in some sense. And the overwhelming preponderance of evidence suggests that you don't get generalization outside the narrow domain. Now, why that is, and even this, it's even worse, because you might say, well, imagine that you could take five different domains of intelligence still associated tightly with G, and you had people practice routines in all five dimensions. Maybe you'd get generalization under those circumstances, and the results of the research attempting that indicate that, no, as soon as you move away from those specific practice instances, you don't get generalization.
Hello, Dr. Peterson.
Hey, there we go.
Tonight, I'd like to ask you about two different psychological disorders, the first being borderline personality disorder. So two lectures ago, somebody asked you about it, and you gave a very sparse answer. I can't remember exactly what you said, but it seemed like it was... there was too much complexity to just answer it right there and then. And then somebody else also asked you about the same disorder in your Patreon live stream recently. And when they asked you that, you kind of stopped for a moment, and something kind of flicked on in your head, it seemed like, and you thought for a couple seconds, and then you said, you know what, I don't think that I can answer that right now because it's just too bloody complex. And I was wondering, just like many young men have gravitated towards your lectures, do you think that there's something about this particular disorder that there's something about people with this particular disorder that might gravitate to your insights and your lectures?
Okay. So now I would say probably no to the second one, but I could comment more about borderline personality disorder. I think I have enough mental energy to do that tonight. So technically speaking, it's often considered the female variant of antisocial personality disorder. So it's classified in the domain of externalizing disorders, acting out disorders. And I think what happens, we don't understand borderline personality disorder very well. I mean, it's characterized by tremendous impulsivity, radical confusion of identity, and then this pattern of idealization of people with whom the person afflicted with the disorder is associating with radical idealization of those people and then radical devaluation of them. And then there's another theme that sort of weaves along with it, which is the proclivity of people with borderline personality disorder to presume that they will be abandoned and then to act in a manner that makes such abandonment virtually certain. And so it's a very complicated disorder, but that, I think, gets at the crux of it. One of the things that's interesting about people with borderline personality disorder, in my experience, is that they're often quite intelligent. And you see in the person with borderline personality disorder something like the waste or the squandering of tremendous potential. They seem capable of thinking through the nature of their problems and analyzing them and discussing it, but not capable whatsoever of implementing any solutions. And technically, there's no relationship between IQ and conscientiousness. It's very weird. Because if you read the neuropsychological literature, and you read about the functions of the prefrontal cortex, they're usually conceptualized in intellectual terms. And they're associated with planning and strategizing and so forth. And that's what conscientiousness is planning and strategizing and implementation. But the correlation between IQ and conscientiousness is zero. And so is the correlation between working memory and conscientiousness. Zero. And zero is a very low correlation, right? I mean, really, it's hard to find things in psychology that are correlated at zero. Things tend to be correlated to some degree. They tend to be interrelated. The borderline seems to be able to strategize and to abstract, but not to be able to implement. And so the intellect per se seems to be functional, but it's not embodied in action. So it can be frustrating to be associated with someone who has borderline personality disorder, because they can tell you what the problem is and even tell you what the solution might be, but there's no implementation. So maybe something went wrong developmentally. We don't know exactly how these sorts of things come about. The other thing that seems to be characteristic of borderline people with borderline personality disorder is that they remind me very much of people who are 2 years old. And in some manner, like, people with borderline personality disorder can have temper tantrums. In fact, they often do. And, you know, now and then you see a temper tantrum, and they're usually thrown by two-year-olds, right? Most people grow out of temper tantrums by the time they're about three. They're very rare at four, which is a good thing, because if they're still there at four, that is not a good diagnostic predictor. That's actually a good diagnostic predictor, but it's not the kind that you want. And, you know, it's funny the way that we respond to two-year-old temper tantrums, because the two-year-old will throw themselves on the ground and beat their hands and their legs on the floor and scream and yell and turn red or even blue. I saw a child once who was capable of holding his breath during a temper tantrum till he turned blue, which was really an impressive feat. You should try that, right? It's really hard. You really have to work at it. And you see that in adult borderlines. They'll have temper tantrums. And the funny thing is, when a two-year-old does it, it's like it's a little off-putting. But when an adult does it, it's completely bloody terrifying. And it happens very frequently with borderlines. And so I would also say, to some degree, they didn't get properly socialized between that critical period of development between 2 and 4. And you see the same thing with adult males who grow up to be antisocial. Because a large proportion of adult males who grow up to be antisocial are aggressive as children, as two-year-olds. And so there's a small proportion of two-year-olds who are quite aggressive. They'll kick and hit and bite and steal if you put them with other two-year-olds. It's about 5% of the males, smaller fraction of the females. But most of them are socialized by the time they're four. But there's a small percentage who aren't, and they tend to stay antisocial, and they tend to turn into long-term offenders. And the critical period for socialization development seems to be between 2 and 4. And it seems to be mediated by pretend play and rough and tumble play and those sorts of mechanisms. And if it isn't instantiated by the age of 4, it doesn't happen. And it doesn't look like it's addressable. Now, there are dialectic behavior therapies that have been developed for people with borderline personality disorder, and they're purported to be successful.
The story in
the story of Adam and Eve is a meta story. And it's a meta story for two reasons. One is, it's about how stories transform, because Adam and Eve are in this unconscious paradise and then it collapses. And that happens to every potential story, right? That's Nietzsche's realization. He said, look, imagine that you live within a belief system, and then something arises to challenge the belief system. Not only does the belief system collapse, but something worse happens. Your belief in belief systems collapses. And that's the road to nihilism. Now, it doesn't have to, because you can jump from one belief system to another. But sometimes that doesn't work, is that you do a meta critique and you say, oh, I was living in this protective structure and it turned out to be flawed. Okay, one alternative is jump to another protective structure. Fine. Another alternative is protective structures themselves are not to be trusted. Bang, you're in chaos. How the hell are you going to get out of that? That's the pathway to nihilism. Well, you can work your way through that. That's difficult. Or you can do what Jung would regard as a soul-damaging move, and you can sacrifice your new knowledge and re-identify with something rigid and restricted, which is what I would say is happening to some degree with the people in Europe who are turning to a regressive nationalism as an alternative to the current state of chaos. It's like, I know that people need to identify with local groups. I understand that. But that they risk the danger of making the state the ultimate god. And that's order, but that's not a good replacement for chaos. It's just another kind of catastrophe, right? Too much order, too much chaos, both catastrophes. You want to stand in the middle somehow and mediate between the two. And that's where you have your real strength. Because then it isn't that you've discovered a safe place. Because even the bloody right-wingers are after a safe place, right? They just want it to be the state. Yeah, exactly. Well, there's no safe places. And the next issue is, do you really want a safe place? Is that what you want? You want to be so weak that you want to be protected from threat? What the hell kind of life is that? You're a paralyzed rabbit in a hole. That's no life for a human being. You should be confronting danger and the unknown and malevolence. And the reason for that, too, is this is the weird paradox. And I believe this is the paradox, first of all, that was discovered in part by Buddha, but also laid forth very clearly in Christianity, which is that the solution to the problem of tragedy and malevolence is the willingness to face them. Now, who the hell would ever guess that? It's a completely paradoxical suggestion. Is that, well, why does it work? Well, because the more you confront the two of them, the more you grow. And maybe you can grow so that you're actually larger than the chaos and malevolence itself. And you think, well, what's the evidence for that? And that's easy. That's what people do. That is how we learn. Like, every time you expose your child to something new, a playground, what are they exposed to? Chaos and malevolence. Now, there's more to it than that, obviously, because kids play and they promote each other and they form friendships and all of that. But in the playground itself, there is the complexity of the social structure and the malevolence of the bully. It's right there. And you throw your kid in there and you say, adapt. And they do. Okay, so they can do it at a small scale. It's not trivial. The playground's a complicated place. The kid can adapt. Well, how much can you scale that up? Can you scale that up from the chaos and order and malevolence of the playground to chaos and order and malevolence itself? Well, that's the question. Well, I don't think there's any reason to answer that in the negative. So, because we don't know the full extent of a human being. And it is the problem that's worked out. So in the Buddha story, for example, what happens after, so Buddha's world collapses in the same way that Adam and Eve's world collapses. It's a consequence of repetitive exposure to mortality and death. What happens to Buddha is he realizes that the little protected city that his father made for him, the walled garden, it's exactly the same motif that's in this Adam and Eve story, it's fatally flawed. That kind of protection cannot exist, and he discovers that in pieces, right? Which is exactly what happens to children, is that they go out, they discover a limit, they run back. And the parents can help them with the limit. They run out, they discover a limit, they run back. But at some point, they run out, they discover a limit, they run back, and the parents have nothing to say to them. Because they've hit the same limit that the parents hit. Which is like, well, what are you going to do with your life? How are you going to operate in this archetypal universe? Well, your parents can only say, Well, they can say you identify with the proper archetypal figures. They do that, they at least act that out for you, but at some point it's a problem that they cannot solve for you without making you weaker. That's the thing, you know. So it's an interesting thing that I've learned in therapy, because one of the things you have to learn as a therapist is how do you not take your client's problems home with you. It's a very common existential problem that beginning therapists face, because they're afraid. It's like, well, you're dealing with people all the time who have serious problems. Sometimes it's mental illness, although less frequently than you'd think, and sometimes it's just that they're having a good catastrophe, right? Their parents have cancer or something like that, or their father has Alzheimer's and they're unemployed, or they have a drug problem, or they have a schizophrenic son, or like, these aren't mental illness problems, right? Those are just catastrophes. And so people are discussing those with you all the time. How do you avoid being crushed by that or avoid taking it home? And the answer to that is, you don't steal the problem. That's the answer. It's like, you have some problems. If you come and talk to me, I'll help you figure out how to solve them. I will not tell you how to solve them. I won't steal your problems. Because what we're trying to do in therapy is, number one, solve your problem. Number two, turn you into a great solver of problems. And the second one is way more important than the first one. And so you never solve someone's problem by removing from them the opportunity to solve their problem. That's theft. That's the Oedipal situation. That's the Oedipal situation. That's the overprotective mother. Now, father can play that role too. We're talking about archetypal representations. It's like, I'll protect you at the cost of your ability to protect yourself. No. Wrong. That's a sin. That's a good way of thinking about it. That is not what you do with people. Not with your children, not with your partner, not with yourself. You don't do that. That destroys people's adaptive competence. And it disarms them in the face of chaos and malevolence. And that's a terrible thing. You're going to send someone out unarmed in a world like that? It's a terrible thing to do. So, and if people aren't strong enough to manage it, then they get resentful. And then, you know, you get the downhill spiral that goes along with that. Okay, so the meta story is partly, you have a map, but it's insufficient, and things will come up to disrupt it, and sometimes the disruption is catastrophic. Everything falls apart. That's what happens to the Buddha, and that's what happens to Adam and Eve. And the rest of the biblical stories are actually an attempt to put that back together. Now, that's been assembled, as I said, it's been assembled over centuries, right? Okay, we've got the problem. The problem is the apocalypse, the ever-present reality of the apocalyptic fall. That's the problem. And so you could say, well, what is that? It's the insufficiency of all potential conceptual schemes. Right. Your conceptual schemes are insufficient to deal with the complexity of the world. It's a permanent problem. So what do? You stop relying on your conceptual schemes. That's part of the answer. You start relying instead on your ability to actively generate conceptual schemes in the face of chaos and malevolence. And so that makes you someone that identifies with your creative capacity, your creative, courageous capacity for articulation and action in the face of the unknown, rather than some formulaic approach to the territory. The idea is that elevates your character to the point where you can withstand tragedy and malevolence without becoming corrupt. And that provides a permanent solution to the problem. Well, then you might say, cynically, what's your evidence that that's a permanent solution? And the answer to that is, well, the evidence isn't all in yet. First of all, because people only live that way partially. And so we haven't put the hypothesis to the full test. And second, we don't know what our limitations are. We have no idea what our limitations are. And they're both greater and lesser than we imagined. Because you have to ask yourself, like, if people stopped adding voluntarily to the misery of the world and devoted themselves to setting things straight, setting themselves straight and setting the things around them straight, what would happen? And the answer to that is, well, there'd be a hell of a lot less unnecessary misery in the world, so that might not be a bad place to start. But apart from that, there's very little that we can say. Could we overcome the catastrophe of mortality? Why not? You think that's beyond our capacity? Could we make the world a place where no one was suffering any more than necessary and still allow the world to exist? Well, possibly, because we don't know the limitations of our capacity. We're only running at 40%, if that, I would say. We don't make full use of all the people that are in the world. We don't have our situation set up so that the gifts that they could offer to everyone are fully realized. We haven't set the systems up for that yet, so we waste people like mad, and then we waste ourselves like mad.
Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, the two treatises of government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.